Entertainment Radio, where variety is the spice of life.
Welcome, everyone, to Readers Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Sheila English. We have a special event show tonight, so I'm really happy to see that we've got some people listening in already. Tonight's guest is a published author, but we won't be talking about his current books. Tonight, we'll talk about the book he's working on and why this book, a book about the assassination of his father, is important to all of us. Joshua Melville, the son of political activist Sam Melville, known for, among many things, leading the Attica Uprising and making political statements through bombings of companies that were making money off the Vietnam War, bombings that by design never killed anybody. Josh's book, American Time Bomb, isn't complete, but we're going to talk about where he is with it now and where he hopes to be in the near future. And I'm going to talk a little bit about how you can help him and make a difference in getting the truth out. So please, everyone, welcome Joshua Melville.
Thank you for having me, Sheila.
Welcome. I know this is a busy time for you. You've got a lot of things going on. You're doing raising some money to get this kind of off the ground. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit, because I learned a lot when I was checking out the site. You have this video, and I'm going to have all these links for people later on when this becomes a podcast. I had no idea that it was so complicated, to get the information that you need in order to complete the book. I guess I thought the Freedom of Information Act, I guess I thought you just filled out a form and they had to give it up. I don't know what I thought. I really didn't.
Yeah.
So that was...
If only that were true, it would be so much easier.
Right.
But alas, yeah. Freedom of Information Act documents are not free. You have to put requests in, and the government typically denies all requests. They, especially in this case, they said, "Well, can you prove to us you have a right to this information?" And I remember when I got that letter in 1988, when I got my first denial from the government in 1988, saying, "Prove to us you have a right to this information." And I had a lawyer at the time, and I said, "I don't understand. I have a right as any normal citizen." And my lawyer said, "No, you have to tell them why you have a specific right. It's just being a citizen theoretically is enough, but in reality, they'll just deny it." So then I said, "Well, I'm his son." And then they made me prove I was a son. I had to have death certificates and all this paperwork. And then they finally said, "Okay, you can have documents, but there are over 4,000 pages of them. And it's going to be 25 cents for each copy of each page." And being a starving artist at the time, I didn't have the money for that. Years later, when I finally did get the money together for it, they changed the regulations as to what they were allowed the size of orders that they were allowed to comply with. And at this point in time in the story, a 4,000-page request was considered, quote, an extra-large request. And that's the technical term, an extra-large request. Sounds like you're going to McDonald's. And extra large requests get put in a back queue, and it can take 3 to 5 years. And then once you get the documents, a lot of them are going to be redacted. So then you have to sue for the unredacted documents, which of course costs more money and takes more time.
Wow. Yeah, I had no idea. I know this has been a journey for you a long time. I'm just learning a lot of this information, and some of it, it's frustrating to me to know this happens, so I can't imagine how that is for you. Before we get started, though, I do want to let people know the live chat session is open, and you can chat with us there if you want to send questions. Or if you want to join us here on the show, you can call in 646-200-4071. This is a live show, but if you miss anything, you can catch the podcast tomorrow on readersentertainment.com. I know some people are just getting to dinner, so don't worry. You will get a chance to hear the whole thing if you miss any of it. Any websites that we discuss will also be made available for you there. on readersentertainment.com. You can also take a look at www.sammelville.com as we talk this evening.
.org.
And
.org.
Oh, is it .org?
Sure.
Sorry. So it's
sammelville.org. If you go to sammelville.com, you'll learn about the actor named Sam Melville, and that probably isn't the one you're looking for.
Oh, no. Okay, so sammelville.org, and learn a little bit more about Josh's death. I think you'll find it very intriguing, and you can look at that while we're talking, and maybe that will inspire some questions. And Josh will be talking about your Indiegogo site, so that people can find out even more detailed information about your personal endeavors writing this book. Josh, can we start out having you give our listeners some history about your father, the political climate at the time, and some of the historical significance of what he was involved in?
Happy to. Well, I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of the Weathermen, the Weather and the Weather Underground, which was a group of radicals who committed a series of political bombings to end the Vietnam War, protest racism. And the Weathermen have become synonymous with other groups like the Symbionese Liberation Army, Black Panthers, and several other organizations that make up what collectively historians call the New Left, which was the liberal social reformation that is commonly referred to as the 60s, which is, you know, that's a very broad term. So the New Left was composed of several important groups, the Yippies. People probably heard of the Yippies. Well, before all these groups became radicalized, they were just protest groups. And my father and several people who were disaffected from these groups became dissatisfied with what they categorized as endless amounts of rhetoric and not enough action. And so he and a number of colleagues got together, formed a collective, and decided that the only thing that they could do to really escalate the revolution to its next stage was to bomb buildings that were profiting off the Vietnam War. Now, this in 2016, this sounds horribly extreme. And when we think of bombings, we tend to think of things like Timothy McVeigh. But there's an enormous difference between those type of bombings or Islamic Jihad type bombings and what my father and his group did. My father was a professional engineer. He designed plumbing systems for the Brooklyn City Hall and Lincoln Center. He worked for a prestigious architectural design firm. And because of his knowledge, he knew how to place these bombs in such a way that they would destroy only property. In fact, nobody was killed in any of his bombings. That can't necessarily be said about the predecessors that he inspired, however. So these bombings were a form of protest. They were not attacks. And once again, in 2016, this seems like an extreme act, but in 1968, 1969, this was the natural progression of how the movement was going. The IRA in Ireland and the FLQ in Canada had already performed hundreds of bombings in the form of protests. It's just that it hadn't happened in the United States yet, and that's my father's contribution to history. He was the first political bomber of the 60s in the United States.
Wow. Now, talking about historical figures, I heard Tom Hayden passed away, and I know you met him. Could you just say a little something about meeting him and about his significance?
Sure. Well, Tom Hayden is the author of the Port Huron Statement, which is considered by many to be the very beginning of the New Left, which Port Huron Statement was published in 1962 or 63, don't quote me on the year. And he was a founding member of the SDS, which is Students for a Democratic Society. And this was a cornerstone group. This is what many people believe started what we commonly refer to as the 60s. Now, these were peaceful people. They didn't do any bombing or anything radical. It was all just done through talk and demonstrations. And the SDS is known for being instrumental in the Columbia University strike and the Columbia University takeover in 1968 and 69, where the students took over the university for over a week and occupied the university. So Tom Hayden's pretty famous. He's probably most famous these days for being married to Jane Fonda and for being a political being a political figure and a councilman. I met him maybe 18 years ago or so on a trip to Los Angeles. He was giving a speech in Beverly Hills, and I'd never met him or seen him before. I only knew about him. And after his speech, I went up to him and I introduced myself and I said, my father was Sam Melville. And he just stared at me. And this has happened a lot in my life. I say, you know, the people in his age group who were old enough to remember and participate in the movement, I say, my father is Sam Melville. And just the jaw just drops because everyone, you know, I was like the little orphaned kid that everybody knew about when my father was murdered at Attica. You know, everyone asked, well, what about his kid? What about Jocko? You know, and this was a subject of, you know, a number of letters and a number of discussions. So now here they are meeting me grown up, and it's kind of a mind blow for them. So Tom took me out to lunch, asked me a lot of questions about my life, and said, you know, you really should continue to figure out what happened to your father. We all know he was murdered, but, you know, it'd be great if you can prove it, if it could be proven. And I had, at that point in time, kind of abandoned my search for this. I went through a period in my 20s where I was very interested in it, and then I wanted to get on with my life and have a family. And at this point in time, I was just about to have my first child. And here comes Tom Hayden saying, yes, you should take up this this Quixote-like mission again. And it did kind of start me back on the path. So I have him to thank or blame, depending on your point of view, for setting me on this path, which has led to the book American Time Bomb. Kind of a long answer, but there you go.
No, but that's very interesting. It is very interesting. So you must have, I mean, you know, Tom Hayden is definitely a name I think a lot of people will recognize. Have you met other people that knew your father that was that were around during that time? Have you had a chance to meet other people who knew what happened to him?
Oh, absolutely. When I was in my late 20s, which was 1989, one of the things I did was I wanted to meet everyone who he was underground with, everyone who was in his bombing group, and people who knew him in prison. And this was for 3 years, although I was working and supporting myself for 3 years, I was like a detective finding these people, and a lot of them go under different names these days, and a lot of them were some of them cooperated with the government, were not easy to get to. But eventually I did manage to speak with all of his co-conspirators, some of whom went to prison and some of whom never went to prison, and people who he was involved with at Attica, who were so-called leaders of the Attica uprising. And I was able to get a lot of information. And this was all before I got his files from the government. And then when I got his files from the government, I was able to, fortunately, like I said earlier, those files are heavily redacted, but because I knew who all these people were, I was kind of able to fill in a lot of the blanks and create a complete portrait of those turbulent events of 1969 through 1971.
Now, you know, I know there's a lot of redacted information, and it sounds like the government is really going to fight tooth and nail to keep their secret. Do you feel like, is the FBI culpable in the escalation of U.S. radicalism and terrorism, you know, via their covert agent provocateur program? Do you think that part of this has, part of the not wanting to give up some information has to do with that?
You know, it becomes a chicken and egg scenario. The FBI was pretty successful in dismantling the Ku Klux Klan in the 1930s and 40s, and they did that with an agent provocateur program. And just in case, let me just briefly explain what that is, in case some of your listeners have never heard that term. The FBI has agents, we all know that, and they have what they call CIs, which are, you know, confidential informants. And then they have people who actually are on the FBI payroll whose job it is to infiltrate a group. And these infiltrators just basically become part of an organization, and they do their best to blend in, and then they await orders from what's called their handler or a control agent. They await orders to then stir that group into action. Now, the FBI and the CIA does this too. In fact, the entire intelligence community operates off of the same basic model. They will use these agent provocateurs. They're called provocateurs because they will say, okay, we want you to provoke them into action. We want you to suggest and incite them into committing an illegal act. Now, sometimes they do this just because they want to make arrests. Sometimes they do this for larger strategic reasons that are difficult to understand in a big picture sense. So you have to ask, this is a philosophical question. If you truly believe that the FBI, CIA, et cetera, that they can do no wrong as long as what they're doing is protecting America, if you're on that side of the politic, then you probably would say no, that there's no culpability there. But if you're not, if you believe that in the act of trying to keep the peace and, you know, prevent this country from being infiltrated by the greater forces, if in the act of doing that, not only are they committing crimes, but they're inciting other people to commit crimes, then those are civil rights violations. And in that respect, yes, they're completely culpable. And this is something I think is going to interest a lot of your listeners. Most people don't realize this. Everyone knows, yeah, there's agent provocateurs, there's CIs, there's people that infiltrate. But from around 1962, 63, if you were in a room full of demonstrators or at a demonstration, you could expect maybe 1 in 20 of the people that were surrounding you to be working for law enforcement undercover. By the time you get to 1968, 69, that number increases approximately 30 out of 100. So 1 in 3 people you're speaking to is an agent. So it's difficult to say, but I mean, if 1 in 3 people you're talking to is there to either gather evidence about you or to provoke you into doing something more illegal, at some point this does become the cause, or at least one of the causes of things that are happening.
So, you know, and that's a lot of stuff to take in and to process, and I know there are a lot of people who are conspiracy theorists, you know, that that already know
some
of this information, but just as an average. Right.
I'm not a conspiracy
theorist. Right, and I know
theorist.
That.
These are hard numbers, and anyone who studied the FBI's MO or has read books about the FBI will know exactly what I'm talking about. I'm not making this up.
Right, and I'm thinking, you know, just as an average person, to hear that, it's a little disconcerting, you know, to think that, you know, that our government might be provoking someone to do some kind of crime in order for them to then take action. I mean, just the fact that they might try to provoke something like that when they can't truly.
Well, it depends on your point of view. Let's take a Timothy McVeigh, for example. Let's say you've got an agent provocateur who's, you know, close to someone like Timothy McVeigh, and you know he's violent and you know he's going to do something horrendous. Do you wait until he does something horrendous? Or do you provoke him to do something horrendous so you can arrest him? Or do you provoke him to do something semi-horrendous so you can arrest him for the smaller crime so he doesn't commit the bigger crime? Sometimes these things get out of control and you end up blowing up an entire, you know, building in Oklahoma City or an entire something else. So you're right in that it's difficult to control. They would argue, the FBI, the CIA, law enforcement would argue, you can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. And so they would argue this is a necessary component of law enforcement. And I'm not taking their side. I'm just telling you what their point of view about this is.
Right, which is that, yeah, that's interesting. I kind of wonder, you know, now that we're in, you know, a post-9/11 era where, you know, a lot of things have changed. And like you had made this point earlier saying that, you know, yeah, there was some bombings that went on, but it was, you know, it was very – very strategic in what was chosen, and at the time it was seen as political activism, where today it would be seen as a terrorist act. Do you feel
it
that
might be. It might be seen as a terrorist act? You have to remember, my father and all of his conspirators were all American and they were all white, and the media seems to want to reserve the word terrorism for Islamics. I'm not condoning that, but it does seem to be a fact. Whenever it's Americans, white people committing acts like this, and they do go on, they don't use the word terrorism, they use some other word, or they'll try to come up with some other word. So it's hard to say, but there's no doubt that his acts, which were framed as heroic by the Vox Populi back then, today would not be considered heroic. That I do agree with.
Yeah, and it's interesting how I know there's going to be some movies coming out. I know that there's some talk about movies coming out about Attica, and I'm not sure how much of that's going to include your father, but it does make me wonder if people will be able to put his acts into context of the time period, as opposed to now everybody just thinks, oh, if you're bombing anything whatsoever, you're pretty much villainized, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and that's what makes this book difficult to write, and that's what's made it difficult to attract the mainstream publisher as well. I'm not trying to justify what my father did. I don't agree with his politics. I don't agree with his actions, but I recognize their importance in history. And so I'm trying to keep the book objective and balanced. And you'd think that would make people both on the left and on the right feel, oh, okay, this is going to be a great book because it's going to be balanced. But it seems like it's having the opposite effect. It seems like people on the left are ambivalent about it because it's not on the left enough. It doesn't justify, violent actions which could have potentially led to murder. They don't like that.
Right.
And so there are people who are friends of the book who've been advisors to me on it who are helping me out of a sense of loyalty and a sense of history, but they're not exactly happy that I'm not taking a hard left viewpoint of it. And conversely, there's people on the right, friends on the right, who say, "Well, why are you writing a book of that glamorizes terrorism in any way?" And I've gotten a few rejection letters from publishers saying, "This is a great story. It's well written. This is going to be a great book, but we're not going to publish it because it's about a terrorist." And so it doesn't seem like, if I went more hard right and condemned my father's actions, I would satisfy one group of people. And if I went the other way and made him a hero all over again, I would satisfy another group of people. I guess I'm hoping that the market for my book are people who want to take an objective look at this and make up their own mind instead of being told what to think.
And I think that that's very admirable, that you're just trying to deliver the information. But now part of the book, a big portion of the book is about your father, but you also are including information about yourself, correct?
Yes, half the book, what sometimes is referred to as a double helix story. There are chapters that are solely about me growing up with this, and then in my 20s, trying to uncover the information. And then there are chapters that jump back in time and are just about Sam and the choices that he made and what he went through and all the information I uncovered. Ideally, these would probably be in two separate books, but it became, commercial point of view, became impossible for me to separate the two stories. And so I found a way to wind them together. This, of course, makes the book a little bit more longer and requires more background and detail. But I'm hoping that I've made it interesting enough that readers will go, okay, yes, I want to understand how these two men of two different generations, how their stories have woven together. And again, telling my story, there's the same kind of thing. People who are on the left kind of wish I followed my father's footsteps. And people on the right and are upset. I think that the ending of the book is the happy ending of the book that I've constructed is one where I transcended all of growing up with this, and I ended up having a wife, two kids, what most people would consider to be a happy, normal life. I think there's people on the left that kind of wish that I had become a revolutionary as well, and are a little disappointed with that. And so that's also, from a commercial point of view, difficult choices that I have to make as a writer.
And it makes me wonder, how do children of radicals and terrorists suffer for their parents' choices?
They suffer a lot. What doesn't matter what you think of your parents' politics, if they've broken the law in any severe way, and you know, you have to remember my father was on the front page of every major newspaper in New York from the moment of his capture right up until the time of his death at Attica. And in fact, when Attica happened, they were withholding the names of people that were killed, but they released my father's name the next day. His obituary was front and center in the New York Times. So for people like that, the FBI doesn't just forget. They don't say, okay, now he's dead, we can close the case on this. They keep tabs on the family. And for years growing up, the FBI would tap our phone, would visit my mother's office, visit my schools. As I grew up and I got from school into finance, they spoke with employers. And they don't ever say, you know, they don't go in with the intention of saying you should not hire this person. They go in with saying, look, we just think you should know who you've hired, and we'd like you to keep tabs on them. If this happens, if that happens, just give us a call. Well, of course, this affects your chances of employment and your chances of advancement in any organization you're going to work in. And the fallout from that is rather tremendous.
Wow, I had no idea. I had no idea. Now tell me, you were talking about in your 20s you were interested, and then you kind of let that go to live your own life, and now you've kind of circled back. Why is this book so important to you personally?
Well, why is it important to me personally? Well, it's cathartic, so there's that. But I just think this is a story that a lot of people can learn from. I know that kind of sounds a little narcissistic, like, you know, here I am, I'm a guy with a story, and if you learn my story, you could learn from me too. But I think there is a lot here. People, by reading this book, will understand, you know, how the FBI works, both in the past and in the present, how if you've been to a demonstration, if you have voiced any kind of negative opinion about the government, you have a file somewhere, and once you have a file somewhere, they add to that file as need be. And if that file reaches a certain girth, then at some point you don't get on their radar and you become a subject for them. And they talk to your friends, family, employers, etc. I think that people learn a lot by understanding that and by understanding how the surveillance age or the information age, depending on your viewpoint, that we're entering into, is going to have a radical effect on our civil rights. And we all know, yes, we're giving up rights with smartphones and every time we click a software agreement and don't read it, but I don't think people really realize the extent to which that information is going to be used either for or against us. I also think people don't understand what could possibly lead a family man, a guy with a nice job, a guy who had a family, who lived in a nice building, what could make such a person just chuck all that and become a bomber? You know, my father read me poetry, and he was a pacifist. How do you go from that to wanting to destroy buildings? And then why is it in this country that someone like that isn't treated as a political prisoner? Why do they end up going to Attica, where you have the baddest of the bad? And the answer is because we have no facility in our justice system for political prisoners, and that's not by accident. It means that my father was charged with basically arson. And it means no matter what crime you commit, even if you do it for political or protest reasons, you're treated like a common criminal. And this is all part and parcel of, you know, the mass incarceration component of this story, which is kind of frightening. In 1971, when my father was killed in Attica, the odds were 1 in 1,000. If you were an American, the odds were 1 in 1,000 that you were a prisoner. That's not that big a deal. You know what those odds are today? They're 1 in 146.
Wow.
That means that for every one, for every person like you, if you know 100, if you know 147 people, the odds are one of them is in prison. And in 10 years, the odds will be probably something like 1 in 60. And where does this lead us? If we keep imprisoning more and more of our population, what does that do to our society? Remember, for every one of these people that's in prison, there's a whole solar system of family members that are disenfranchised by that incarceration. And those numbers grow and grow and grow. And if you think this is a liberal cause, well, it's not, because who do you think pays for all these prisoners? Taxpayers pay for all these prisons. We pay for all these prisoners. So this is something that affects everybody. So I think through this story, there's going to be a lot of life lessons that people are going to be, find interesting. I'm hoping anyway.
So we're about out of time, but I'd like for you to tell people how they might be able to help you complete your book and where they can go to find out more.
Well, the easiest thing to do is go to the Indiegogo page. And if they go to Indiegogo.com and they just type in American Time Bomb, and Time Bomb is one word, they'll be taken right to the page. They can watch a video, explains everything. They can see the whole story of the text. They can read sample chapters. They can hear music that my father wrote and him and I singing when I was just, you know, 7 years old. They can hear all that, and they can get a real feel for what this story is about. And, of course, this is all free, but if they'd like, they can make a donation, which would be greatly appreciated. That's what they can do today. And if they can't do that, they can just show their support by either clicking this forward or sharing the link for this interview with their friends.
Great. Josh, I want to thank you for taking the time to join us tonight and for being so candid about your life and about the life of your father. We certainly wish you luck with completing the book and hope that you'll come back once it's out.
Thanks so much. I'll be happy to do that.
And I want to thank our listeners for joining us here at Readers Entertainment Radio. I'm your host, Sheila English, and I'm glad that you joined us, and happy reading, everybody.